Welcome to the Technocracy News Hour. I am Patrick Wood, your host. I invite you to visit technocracy.news to stay abreast of the current news relating to technocracy. And if you haven't done so yet, please take a look at my book, Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. This book is the A to Z documentary, if you will, on the historic technocracy movement and how it is playing out in current global affairs, and also how it's affecting everyone in the United States of America. Please check it out. It's available on Amazon.com. It's also available on technocracy.news. And now, our program for today. We're speaking today with Larry Kogan, a lawyer, attorney from New York City, in New York. And Larry, thank you for coming on the program today.
You're welcome, Pat. Thank you for having me.
You know, we've been talking offline a little bit about a situation that's developed in Montana that you have been instrumental in breaking a story there. It has to do with the Indian communities and the Indian reservations in the United States. A very interesting topic. I'm from Arizona, as you know, and this is a reservation state. We have lots of different Indian tribes in Arizona. I drive by two of them every day, almost every day, when I'm out on the road out here in the Phoenix area. And we have always understood, although we don't have a lot of interaction with the Indian community here, we've always understood that the Indian communities around the country are essentially sovereign entities, that the normal laws that we obey in the United States of America are basically suspended in those communities, and they make their own laws, and they have their own police forces, and they have their own courts, court system, and they're basically immune to, while they're on the reservation, they're basically immune to U.S. law. It's an interesting situation that nobody really thinks about, because the Indian communities just don't come up. For the most part, I think people think of gambling and casinos and stuff like that. When they hear the word Indian reservation, they think, oh, that's where the new casino is. Well, we got lots of them here in Arizona, and there's lots of them around the country. But this is a story of a different angle, what you uncovered up in Montana. And I'd like to maybe preface this by stating that the president, interestingly enough, has, since he's been president, has issued two executive orders pertaining to Native American affairs. One was on December 2nd, 2011. It was executive order something like 13592, which deals with improving American Indian and Alaska Native education opportunities and strengthening tribal colleges and universities. And then the second one was on June 26, 2013, an executive order that established a White House Council on Native American Affairs. And I remember when I first saw these two, or at least the second executive order in 2013, I thought to myself, what on earth is President Obama doing with or to the Native American communities, the Indian reservations in America? And I didn't dig into it as much as I should have, perhaps, but it struck me as strange that the president would even give second thought to the Indian reservations in America, considering his general agenda. So with that as kind of a preface, Larry, tell us what you uncovered in Montana in particular.
Well, in Montana, we had filed a lawsuit on a very short notice basis in early September of 2015. And our clients were two state senators, one sitting and one former, and then a small recreational business up in the northern part of the reservation area at Flathead Lake. And they were concerned, the people were concerned, and those supporting the lawsuit, because this was really a community effort with the faces of three people on the lawsuit, they were concerned about the transfer of a major dam by the federal government to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribe located on the Flathead Indian Reservation in northwestern Montana. And they were concerned because the tribe had acquired a major piece of federal infrastructure at a bargain sale price without any conditions. And this deal had been made in 1985 during the Reagan era when James Watts was the Department of Interior Secretary. So you would have thought that a Republican administration would have watched out for the American public in undertaking such a transfer. And they kind of didn't. And when we were doing the research to figure out exactly what the license transfer relating to the dam related to, we found that the dam provision, that the license's provisions had doubled in the course of the 1990s through a secretive procedure engaged in by the Clinton Department of Interior and Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, where they basically added 30 new articles to this license that imposed environment and wildlife provisions restrictions on the dam operator. At that time, the dam operator was a private enterprise. And the public in Montana had no say-so as to these conditions. There was no public hearing.
Now, where exactly is this dam located, Larry?
This dam is the Kerr Dam, and it's located at the base of the Flathead Lake, leading to the Flathead River, which has several tributaries. The further south it flows, northwest through the Clark Fork River, up through Lake Pendere up in Idaho, up just past the Canadian border, and down through the Columbia River out to the Pacific.
Okay.
So we're talking about a major Columbia River Basin dam. And it sits below a dam that's twice or even three times the size of it, known as the Hungry Horse Dam. Now, that dam is in the possession of the U.S. government. It's managed by the Department of Interior's Bureau of Reclamation. The Kerr Dam sits on U.S. federal land held in trust for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. So it, in effect, was managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs of the Department of Interior. Now, the conveyance by FERC and the Department of Interior to the tribes of this dam was to be, in effect, a political deal in reparation for the harms, I guess, visited upon the tribe, having been vanquished back in the 1800s and having been the subject of a treaty known as the Hellgate Treaty of 1855. And the tribe's modus operandi here has been for the longest period of time to regain its aboriginal lands and waters, and this dam is a major piece of that puzzle. And when you sequence the release of reservoir waters from the Hungry Horse Reservoir with the Kerr Dam Reservoir, you can generate a lot of water power, which can be used to generate a lot of electricity.
Exactly.
And it seems, based upon our investigation, that when we went further, we found that the federal government has been basically making a federal power play to ensure its control over the water resources of northwest Montana. It is an abundant source of water that flows in from British Columbia that works its way through these two dams out into the Clark Fork River, out up and through Idaho, and back down through the Columbia River Basin.
Right. And, of course, when we talk about just the dam, we're not talking about the entire reservoir system that's being intended to be transferred.
We haven't even talked about the irrigation system.
Right, right.
That's a separate major federal infrastructure project that was undertaken in the early 20th to the mid-20th century.
Right.
Because it took many years to build the complex labyrinth of canals that now exist.
Right. So the dam in question right now, it's a big dam. I'm looking at a picture of it right now. This is what's at the center of the controversy, in any case. And whoever owns the dam obviously has
that. That was the center of our lawsuit controversy, right, for that particular item. But there's many other items here.
Gotcha.
Because when you look at all of the infrastructure, the feds control the dam through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The reservation itself is federal land that is held in trust for the tribe. It's not owned outright by the tribe. The infrastructure, the irrigation system has been retaken by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, even though it was to be maintained and controlled by the settlers once the cost of constructing the irrigation system was paid off, which it was back, I believe, in 2008. And the irrigators were able to reclaim management and control over the irrigation system in 2010, and then it fell apart in 2013. The BIA took it over. And then there's the electricity transmission system. There's a electrical utility known as Mission Valley Power that is also managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and operated by the tribe according to a preferential contract with the federal government. See, the important thing here is not just recognizing that the federal government controls all the resources on and pertinent to the reservation, but also to know that the Fed really is using the tribe as a proxy to maintain that control. And the tribe is placed in this position because of its status as a federally recognized tribe. In fact, it is the first federally recognized tribe in the nation. And this apparatus was created pursuant to the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, which essentially stopped the Dawes Act allotment and Homestead Act laws that were put into place in the late 1800s through the early 1900s, intending to assimilate the Native Americans into the broader American culture by giving them parcels of land on communal Indian reservations for which they would be responsible and which they would own themselves and for which they would pay state taxes.
Okay, and, so we can probably fast forward a tad here, having understood that there's a relationship between the federal government and the tribe. There's also the possibility, as the tribe is considered a sovereign nation, that the tribe is able to have relationships with other governments around the world.
Right, but if we were to look at just a federally recognized tribe vis-a-vis the Department of Interior, Bureau of Indian Affairs, means that they are eligible to receive hundreds of millions of dollars from the federal government, U.S. taxpayers, for undertaking various activities. And they are treated in a way that promotes their self-governance, their self-determination, and their tribal sovereignty as a separate nation. A separate nation, albeit, that is tethered to the purse strings of Congress as a ward of the federal government. Nevertheless, they're treated as a sovereign nation, so they don't abide by and are not required to abide by the federal constitution or the state constitution. The state government really does not have jurisdiction over the reservations, and the federal government certainly and also does not have jurisdiction except in the event a federal crime is committed.
Would they be required to adhere to any State Department policies?
Nope. They wouldn't be required to really adhere to anything because they're sovereign nations, albeit tethered to the federal fisc. Now, Congress could turn off the money spigot, and these guys would be left high and dry, these tribes. That's the way they influence them, is by turning on and off the money spigot. So these tribes, this CSKT, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribe, along with 16 other federally recognized tribes, were invited by the government of Turkey, for example, in 2010 for an all-expenses-paid trip to Istanbul. Now, why would you ask, would Turkey be interested in federally recognized tribes?
Now, wait a minute. Turkey is somewhat of an ally to the United States, but they're still a radical Muslim nation. Is that correct?
Okay. As you may recall, Turkey is a part of the NATO alliance, North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And during the Cold War, NATO allies stuck together. They had a mutual defense agreement. One's attacked, they're all attacked. And it was pretty much placed squarely against the Soviet Union when there was one. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, Turkey has been adrift to some extent, and over the last 10 years has changed due to the election of Prime Minister Erdogan, who is a known Islamic proponent and one who states that his goal is to create a caliphate in the Middle East through Turkey and to resurrect the Ottoman Empire of yore. And these days, it's disagreed within the U.S. government whether Turkey remains the same NATO ally it once was. So Turkey is looking to promote exchange of culture, education, and business with Native American tribes. And as we found in the preparation of our lawsuit, they had lobbied Congress heavily in 2010 and 2011 to have the ability to do business on Indian reservations. And they actually got a Congressman Cole out of Oklahoma, the only known sitting Indian legislator in the U.S. Congress, to propose a bill that would allow for the leasing of Indian reservations by Turkish enterprises, and they had six or seven Indian reservations in mind, for up to 75 years with renewal for educational, business, agricultural reasons, purposes. And when they tried to move this bill out of committee, it didn't really fly because people were concerned that Turkey, which was known to harbor terrorist groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, they didn't feel comfortable with that. So there was a parallel bill that was introduced by the congressman of a neighboring state of yours, New Mexico, Congressman Heinrich. And he introduced something known as the HEARTH Act, H-E-A-R-T-H, which was an acronym to say that this was a bill to help Indian education and housing. But it was pretty much identical to the Turkey bill of Congressman Cole, except for the fact that it opened up these reservation leasing arrangements to all federally recognized tribes. And you got to remember that there are 566 of them, and 326 of them have reservations. So basically, they open up 326 reservations to leasing for agricultural, educational, business, and get this, religious purposes. This is no mention of Turkey in this bill. And again, for up to 75 years. And if the tribe's leasing regulations in general meet with the approval of the Department of Interior, then there would be no oversight over specific lease arrangements entered into with either domestic entities or foreign entities.
Well, so, this is making me a little bit nervous now.
It should raise concerns, but it didn't. And there are just as many or more Republicans that approved this because it was in the name of free enterprise.
Free trade.
Free trade.
Yes, indeed.
But so we came across this information, and then we found out all the information from Middle Eastern, European, and American media sources that showed that Turkey was harboring these terrorist groups that some of these terrorist groups are now in the United States. And wouldn't it suit them well if they found a jurisdiction such as Indian reservations that have no federal oversight or state oversight to use as a platform to do whatever they're going to do? And that could be the spreading of Islam, or it could be the planning and designing of terrorist attacks. One would not know.
Let me ask just a couple of hypothetical questions. This is not a real situation at all, but just to understand how things are. Let's say that the State Department or the administration wanted to get $1 million to Turkey and not have it show up on anybody's budget. In other words, the black hole, the slush fund. Would it be theoretically possible for them to use the BIA funding mechanism to pass money to the tribe, and the tribe could somehow pass money directly back to any foreign entity as a sovereign nation, if you will, for whatever purpose they might want to transfer it back?
I mean, there's all types of possibilities, but that probably wouldn't be one of the ones that I would think of.
Yeah, okay. I'm not saying it would happen. I'm just saying
the only reason I'm saying that is because they can do a lot more through general funds for, let's say, international institutions that end up in Turkey's hands.
Well, of course they can.
They can do it through. Listen, they have a nuclear cooperation agreement with Turkey,
right?
For civilian nuclear plants, where they can funnel in money so that Turkey can develop its science. They have, you know, R&D agreements. They've got science and technology agreements.
Right.
So lots of ways they can pass the money through.
Let's say that Saudi Arabia wanted to build a mosque on a reservation. Is there any federal oversight or concern about that? Or they just go and do it and nobody knows they did it?
The Saudi government wouldn't do it directly. The Saudi government would probably use a trade association or some cultural organization in the United States and go through back channel in order to fund it as something look innocuous looking.
Right.
And then they would, you know, build it wherever they wanted to build it. Now, if they built it on a federal reservation, there would be no oversight. As long as the tribe's leasing regulations in general have been approved, then there's nothing to say that the federal government would be interested in what's happening otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm driving at is it seems to me like there's a cloak of invisibility around the Indian reservation itself. I think that's true. The picture that's coming up in my mind here.
Federally recognized tribes do not believe they are accountable to anybody because they are sovereign nations. Okay. They are treated differently as legal fiction by different federal agencies. For instance, EPA has a program known as Treatment as States, where they treat federally recognized tribes as a sovereign U.S. state for purposes of implementing Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, if they meet certain eligibility requirements. That means you're displacing a state's jurisdiction under shared jurisdiction with EPA by throwing in a tribe into the mix. So the state doesn't have jurisdiction over that area. The tribe does.
The tribe does, right.
Okay, now take that and look at how tribes are treated under the Homeland Security Act of 2002. In that piece of legislation, they're treated as a municipal government. So they've knocked down a rung in the hierarchy of government-to-government relations. Now, what we found interesting was when they decided to do the Kerdam transfer, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, for purposes of creating the legal fiction to transfer the dam and the license, they treated the tribe as an instrumentality of the federal government. So you have the federally recognized tribe being treated three different ways by three different federal agencies, and you're left with the question of what are they? what kind of sovereignty do they have, and what level of non-accountability are they entitled to? We did not get any information, and nor have any other Montana interveners in the FERC process get any information as to the safety of the dam upon transfer or after transfer, or regarding the security of the dam from terrorist attack during or after the transfer. The tribe would not account. And any information that you would try to find on the FERC website was considered, quote-unquote, classified confidential. So you couldn't, no member of the public could find that out, which should make people nervous.
It should make people nervous.
This is not just dealing with Kerr Dam. You've got other dams along the Columbia River that that are surrounded by Indian reservations. Okay, you've got nuclear power plants around the country that are within 100 miles of Indian reservations. That was one of the things we found out also, that there were 14 tribes with reservations that had been invited to Turkey, that Turkey had earmarked as a tribe to do business with, that had reservations located within 100 miles of a nuclear power plant, a nuclear fuel facility, or uranium mines. The Flathead Indian Reservation in northwestern Montana had uranium deposits all around its periphery. So we were wondering, what else does the tribe have, the CSKT tribe have, that is of interest to the Republic of Turkey? Well, the tribe does business with the U.S. Air Force in cleaning up uranium mill tailing spills. It has business with the U.S. Air Force and with foreign air forces in procuring parts replacement. And three countries come to mind: Saudi Arabia, Libya, and Turkey. And just this past fall, the CSKT was awarded another Department of Defense contract to do software logistics, software systems, at the Savannah Nuclear Weapons Facility in Savannah, Georgia. That would lead reasonable people to question whether Turkey's after something related to nuclear power.
I'd ask that question.
Right, and in our recent Social Science Research Network report, SSRN website report, we found that Turkey is indeed after civilian nuclear power, having undertaken contracts with a Japanese-French consortium with the Russian government to build nuclear power plants in Turkey. And there was a recent merger in the United States with a Colorado-based company acquiring a Turkish company for purposes of doing uranium mining and refining in Turkey. And they happen to have a facility out of Texas, which they were going to move to Turkey for that purpose. So they had the technology, and the Obama administration approved of it. We also found, as you are familiar, that the water from these two big dams, the Kerr Dam and the Hungry Horse Dam, could be used in such a way as to generate electricity for an Idaho National Laboratory facility in Idaho Falls, Idaho, which is known as the preeminent facility in the country for nuclear fuel reprocessing of spent nuclear fuel rods and for the creation of new types of nuclear fuel. So Montana seems to be at the epicenter of a lot of different activities that the residents of Montana were unaware of prior to our lawsuit and subsequent research.
I don't know that I'd be so concerned if Turkey wasn't led by a man who is dedicated to establishing a caliphate in the Mideast. But
yeah,
because he is, that would be enough of a red flag to say this is not only just a conflict of interest just on any level, but it's could be potentially a huge national security risk.
Well, you have that coupled with the fact that this administration is known to be advised by the Muslim Brotherhood.
That's right.
In the White House, that the national security agencies have to some extent been compromised by those people, that policy is now being run with that, with that lens in place, that the U.S. was partially responsible for the birth of ISIS, that Turkey harbors ISIS and facilitates it through purchases of fuel from Iraq and Syria, that has been captured by the ISIS, and the FBI's confirmation that ISIS elements are in the United States in all 50 states. And when you take all that into account and you have sanctuaries of anonymity in these reservations without any accountability to the public at all, you know, no matter where you are located, if you're in a state with Indian reservations, you should be concerned.
So potentially a tribe could lease a little piece of ground to somebody like Turkey, call it a cultural center, and Turkey could come in and basically do anything on that piece of ground, way out in the middle of nowhere, by the way. All of these reservations are in the middle of nowhere, essentially. Well, at least a lot of them are. So they could establish any kind of facility they wanted, call it what they want, cultural center, whatever, but they could turn it into a radical mosque and or a terrorist training camp if they wanted to, and who would know the difference? And even if they did, who could enforce it?
And they don't even have to do it directly. It could be through other organizations that have little or no affiliation to the Turkish government.
Yep. But there's a shield up in any case. There's an automatic cloak of invisibility around the reservation entity.
Yes. Around the boundaries, within the boundaries of that reservation, there is no obligation of that tribal government to report to any other government. In fact, the interesting thing that we found with Kurd Dam was that the state of Montana doesn't even engage in Department of Homeland Security information exchange. And the dam was last inspected in 2012. So there was no recent information about dam safety and security that had been posted by the state of Montana. The issue here, though, is that you could have nefarious groups, organizations that have been sponsored, that are affiliates of organizations sponsored by the government of Turkey or Saudi Arabia or Libya or any other Middle Eastern country, establish a beachhead in the United States through a U.S. affiliate and have members of those organizations sitting on a reservation without anybody knowing. What they would do on that reservation could be anything. They could build madrasas. They could build buildings that don't look like mosques and still serve as madrasas. Or they could plan attacks within the U.S. One of the things that one of my clients had written in their FERC administrative interventions was a concern about EMP attack, electromagnetic pulse attack, which all you would need to do is basically have uranium, refine it, turn it into yellow cake, and launch something with it. And you have a little explosion, and you can cause an EMP scenario. And there is much literature that we referenced in our lawsuit talking about EMP and the risk to dam security and safety posed by terrorists. It's only exacerbated when you deal with Indian reservations.
You know, I remember the last time, and I think it was around 2013, when President Obama was executing some policies with the Indian communities around the country. It kind of came out of nowhere to me because I wasn't expecting him to do anything with the Indian world. But when the press release came along that he was fiddling with regulations and fiddling with the structure of the Indian reservations. I thought to myself at the time, he's undoubtedly found a loophole of some kind. I didn't explore maybe as much as I should have to find out, well, what is this loophole that he's found, discovered, and what might he use it for? But I have a feeling that this sitting president, as well as all of his minions at the State Department, etc., have found an international loophole to exploit, potentially, against the people of the sovereign United States.
Well, he's actually implementing a UN declaration on indigenous rights, which basically calls for the restoration of Aboriginal lands and waters, among other things. He actually has a signing statement or an affirmative statement of implementation that he made public over the last year and a half that shows exactly that that his policies are implementing that UN declaration. So he's taking a soft law mechanism, a reflexive law mechanism in the UN, which has no legal force and effect of its own right, and implementing it through national policy, which then reduces it to law.
Right. Just regulations, in other words, or just...
Regulations, yeah. You know, executive orders, et cetera. Executive orders only apply to federal agencies. But they have a funny way of finding their way into the private markets.
Right. So how many Indian reservations are there in America?
Well, there's 326 reservations and 566 federally recognized tribes. So in other words, to say it differently, there's 326 of 566 tribes have reservations.
Yeah. That's between 3 and 5 per state.
Yeah, and some states have more.
That's right. Arizona certainly has more.
Well, and Arizona has tribes that are sitting around uranium.
That's right.
The Navajo complex between northeastern Arizona, northwestern New Mexico, and southern Utah is got to be the richest uranium belt in the country.
That's right. And it's unfortunate for the government originally that pushed the Indians off on these reservations. They didn't know what kind of minerals existed on those properties, because to the naked eye they were like the outback of Australia. Just often barren, often badlands that nobody else would want, they felt. And more recently, they've discovered great resources hidden on these reservations that they basically thought they were giving worthless land to. So there's a lot of interest, I realize, just for that reason, that the Indians are sitting on valuable assets that other people would like to get their hands on.
Right, and you see that same scenario being played out now in relation to the Hammond Ranch out in Burns, Oregon. There are minerals all over central and southeastern Oregon. And this mineral presence is supported by at least half a dozen U.S. Geologic Survey reports that had been released spanning the years 1968 through 1987. In fact, there's even more recent reports leading up to 2015. And these are on federal lands because, as you know, out west, the federal government owns a predominance of the land in many states. I think Oregon must have 70% of the land that's owned by the federal government. Washington State, I think it's a higher percentage. So, yeah, the feds are managing these lands, trying to keep people off, both for environmental purposes, wildlife purposes, and now mineral purposes. And the tribes want to get their hands on this stuff because it's one way of repairing the damage that was done to them over the years.
The Bundy Ranch in southern Nevada also is associated with uranium.
Yes, I mean, there's, you know, in order to, you know, to precisely conclude that the minerals sit under their property, you need a proper survey. I don't know the extent to which the Bundy Ranch actually sits on minerals, but I do know that there were minerals known to be around it. The same thing with the Hammond Ranch.
Right.
I haven't seen a survey, but I do know that the U.S. government has a lot of research data showing minerals around it and north, and you know, especially south of it, along the Nevada border.
Well, this is very disturbing in general, because we've seen the propensity of the federal government to grab large tracts of resource-heavy land, especially in the West. We've seen this over a period of, gosh, at least 25 to 30 years, and it's gotten worse in recent days. And in some cases, it's absolutely blatant that these resources are being they're being grabbed and tucked away from any other commercial use. That is blocking other businesses that might have used that property for some extraction purposes, and basically just swept it under the wing of the federal government, saying, no, you can't touch that now. If you ever do touch it, it'll only be because we give you a license to go do something on that property. Which they're not giving licenses, by the way. But we have the government through the auspices of, like, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, grabbing up large tracts of land, trying to drive farmers, ranchers, especially ranchers, off of leases that in many cases have been held for over 100 years. And nobody has asked the question, what does the government want with all these resources? What's the point of locking up these things? Well, sooner or later, there has to be a conduit to profit on that.
Well, more than, you know, in addition to the profit motive, there's also the preservation motive, which ties back into this notion of sustainable development. And you must not touch nature, and you must leave it in a pristine state. So if they don't exploit the natural resources, such as the minerals, and they leave it in a state of nature, quote-unquote, then they service what the Obama administration would say is its legal obligation under sustainable development treaties, one of which I'm sure you're aware of is the Biodiversity Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, having interviewed Debbie Bacigalupi, she has told you about Sustainable Development and Agenda 21 and the biodiversity regions with specific land and waters earmarked for preservation, and where the regions are not physically connected, they create corridors, and this must also figure into the grand plan of the administration. It certainly did during the Clinton administration with Bruce Babbitt at the helm of the Department of Interior.
That's for sure. And back to, now that you mentioned Bruce Babbitt, by the way, that brings up another angle that I'd like to discuss.
Bruce Babbitt's president, you know, he is president indirectly in Montana through his former lawyer, John Leshy, who runs the Weiss Foundation, W-Y-S-S Foundation.
Really?
Which is funded by socialist progressives, such as George Soros.
Yeah.
And it's operated by other former Clinton Department of Interior officials.
Isn't that interesting?
And we had, you know, there is information out there on the web that is available on another website, that can be made public to everybody, that shows that what this group has done and all the connections between the former Clinton officials. But they're in Montana because what they do is it's operated or run by a Swiss billionaire who wants to preserve all the land, buy up ranches and farms, and then sell it or gift it to the federal government, put it into federal preserve.
And lock up the resources.
Lock up the resources. This happened on the Flathead Indian Reservation, actually in the last month or so. You had an estate that was being settled, and they sold off their vast acreage to the Bureau of Reclamation of the Department of Interior, and the Department of, and the Bureau of Reclamation basically gave it to the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So they give it to the tribe, or they put it into Federal Reserve, depending upon whether there's a tribe nearby, in order to make sure it's not touched. It's happening out in the Klamath River Basin. It's another area ripe with dispute.
Right. Well, we have Bruce Babbitt, who was originally from Arizona, northern Arizona, actually. And for a time, he was the governor of our state before he took a position ultimately as under Bill Clinton as Secretary of the Interior in the 1990s. And there was a lot of talk in Arizona back in when Clinton first announced that it was going to be Bruce Babbitt that was put forth as the presidential candidate. And both Bill Clinton and Bruce Babbitt at the time were members of the elitist Trilateral Commission. And Bruce Babbitt, of course, went on as he became Secretary of Interior. He was the man who single-handedly crafted the policy of dam destruction and removal in the United States. And all of the dams that are currently slated for destruction, we can trace back specifically to Bruce Babbitt. That was his policy, to return the land supposedly to nature, put it back the way it used to be 500 years ago. And I think I read at one time there's something like 30,000 dams that potentially could be on that destruction list in America. But I wonder, now since you've mentioned that there is a direct Babbitt connection to Montana, I wonder if the Kerr Dam is on that list for dam removal.
No, the Kerr Dam isn't because of the electricity potential of that dam.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, they haven't sought to remove it. Now, the ones in the Klamath are smaller than Kerr.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't generate as much electricity. And the dam owner is Warren Buffett. And Warren Buffett insisted that he would take them down only if the federal government could indemnify him for any liability that might arise for knocking down four dams that would release toxic sludge that came from Portland. And that would devastate the environment. They also guaranteed Warren Buffett's company, Pacific Core, the ability to generate new electrical revenues by piping in his vast wind farms and solar panel power from Nevada. So he got a sweet deal, which would cost ratepayers money to indemnify him.
Indeed.
There were three compacts in the Klamath. It was a river restoration agreement, there was a dam takedown agreement, and then there was an upper basin, I guess, ecosystem agreement, which were all interrelated, that were all enacted, or they were agreed to in 2010, and they were supposed to be ratified by Congress no later than beginning of 2016. And they involved the states of Oregon, California, the tribes, various federal agencies. And fortunately for the irrigators, they resisted for 5 years. And finally, Congress, under this leadership, basically said, we're not going to ratify these things. And they expired on January 1 of this year. Now, the tribes and the environmentalist community and the states are thinking of ways to implement these compacts in pieces rather than go through them in whole. Because if Congress wasn't going to approve them in pieces, in the whole, they were going to try to figure out how to do this piecemeal. And that's what irrigators are now trying to figure out, how they're going to offset this. One of the interesting things I found in Montana was that the legislators proposing and supporting the CSKT water compact were saying, look at Klamath. You all don't want to oppose the compacts in Klamath, because by opposing the compacts, as they did in Klamath years ago, their land values dropped because of the threat of litigation. Well, that was a lot of hyperbole, because it was really the opposition by the people in Klamath that led to the downfall of those compacts. They couldn't be ratified by Congress. They won't do it. So the lesson to be learned in Montana is oppose the CSKT water compact for up to 4 to 5 years so that the tribes or the state can activate the provision in the compact that says they can get out of it.
This is interesting.
So what we try to do is relate to people in Montana the lessons to be learned in the Klamath, because land values will drop, and they're already dropping on the reservation when people learn that they have no say as to or access to the water except for when the tribe wants to release it. Now, a lot of the water source for irrigation on the Flathead Reservation comes from the mountains. And the way the mountain basin is situated, the water flows in from the mountains from the winter, from the snow, runs down the bottom of the basin up to the north part of the reservation. And for most of the irrigation season, they can rely on that water, and that water is stored in reservoirs among 11 or 12 dams on the reservation. The problem is the tribes own all the dams, and they decide when to let the water flow. This past spring, for instance, they let the water flow during the height of the irrigation season because of the fish. They want the fish to swim comfortably without anxiety. And these were upper Columbia Basin fish, not lower Columbia Basin fish or ocean salmon.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And the point is, it's not the irrigator's concern for raising crops or feeding cattle. It's rather the livelihoods of the fish that most concern the tribe, because it is their cultural, religious, indigenous right to fish, and they want to make sure there's a bounty of fish.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible. We're kind of getting close to our time, but I want to go back and just to impress on people's minds the 300-plus reservations that exist around our country, that on one hand are under the scrutiny and somewhat control, at least monetarily, of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is an agency of the U.S. government. And on the other hand, is considered to be a sovereign nation, able to conduct business with foreign nations as if they were a sovereign state. It's interesting, in the United States, I don't think this has ever been enforced. Maybe once or twice it was tried to be enforced, but there is an old-time law. I believe it was called the Logan Act, that made it illegal for a state government to negotiate directly with a foreign government.
That doesn't exist anymore, and that was broken down by the sustainable development community.
Okay.
What they've done is essentially taken vertical jurisdiction, mm-hmm, between federal, state, and local, and made it horizontal. You've heard of vertical companies versus horizontal companies?
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got horizontal government, where you can have a state, a city, and a federal government sitting side by side and having direct access to foreign governments. Now, a state government cannot enter into a treaty with a foreign government, but it can enter into executive agreements, as can a municipal government. And municipal governments can enter into executive agreements with other municipal governments all around the world. And that's what the UN Sustainable Development Engine is premised on, those relationships where they can share information, they can share agendas in implementation of Agenda 21, which is itself an implementation of the larger UN Sustainable Development initiatives that are agreed by national governments around the world at the UN. Now, this is not a system of laws and standards and regulations pushed down by the UN upon national governments. Rather, it's national governments working together using an international body to facilitate the exchange and the transfer of mutual obligations between one and another. These are the platform. And then they bring in from that international platform all that they want to implement at the national, state, or local levels.
That's amazing. So now we have one more level then of complexity with these Indian reservations around our nation. And I'm getting the picture of a big block of Swiss cheese. We know ourselves as the United States of America. Founded as a republic, of course, but nevertheless, the United States of America. But if within those United States of America, we have 300 plus sovereign entities that are not part of the United States of America, then it kind of conjures up this picture of a big block of Swiss cheese in my mind. That how can we be united on so many policies that we need to be united on with this kind of conflict sitting in the midst of us in every single state in our nation?
That is a profound problem.
That's amazing.
And these guys still... well, let's put it this way. If you follow sustainable development programs, you will note that the whole notion of cons perpetual peace was to make sure that nation states don't go to war with one another. And the only way to do that is to reduce the size of the nation state and to reduce the resources. So the more you can undermine the United States as a global hegemon cannot use its financial and military might to threaten another nation, then you find this enterprise put into motion by the Obama administration acceptable. I mean, he is a foreign president. He looks at things internationally, not through the lens of U.S. national security or U.S. national interest. He is the first president, actually, that has ever done that.
That's right.
And it's a surprise that nobody in Congress has nerve enough to impeach him, because he has violated the Constitution more than any other president.
Yes, he has.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're not for a big, strong United States, you want all these sovereign nations within our borders. And you want to keep open borders, which is what he's doing as well. Open borders seems to be his mantra. You allow in the immigrants, the migrants, whether or not they meet U.S. national immigration law. Mm. And that includes refugees.
That's right.
You create sanctuary cities, or you allow sanctuary cities to operate without federal pushback.
I wonder how many... refugees are being sent to Indian reservations around the country.
Well, that's something that we've heard information or fears about, but we don't have any hard information.
I'm not sure the Indians would like them, but you never
know.
Well,
they complain about the risk of Islamic assimilation. And what the ones that I've spoken to have asked for more money and more sovereignty so they can watch their own. But they don't watch for anybody else. They just watch for their own. So why give them more sovereignty when they're already abusing the current sovereignty? And then we have to give them more U.S. taxpayer money to protect themselves. And they're really not interested in protecting us because they still harbor resentment.
Yeah, really? Yeah, like what do we have to do, give them all their guns back?
Right, okay. And they still expect welfare entitlement.
Exactly.
I mean, the old laws used to say that that the U.S. government has, and it still says, the U.S. government has a fiduciary responsibility to protect Indian tribes and to serve their beneficial interests. And when they are declared a federally recognized tribe, they are eligible for a financial bounty from the federal government,
right,
all types of things. Now, to remove oneself from that tribal trust state/ward relationship, the laws have said that either the tribal member must own a piece of property in fee simple and pay taxes for it, or must undertake or engage in a civilized lifestyle, i.e. assimilate,
mm-hmm,
away from the tribe, away from the communal manner of things. Either one of those activities would take them out from ward status and have them be independent. But that has not occurred in many cases. And the biggest problem of all that is what we found out from speaking to tribal members in Montana, members of the Flathead Indian tribe, the CSKT. They said that basically they live in squalor. They get none of the bounty that the federal tribal government collects from the federal government. They have all these contracts with federal agencies, and none of the money gets shared among the tribal members equitably as should be, and as is required for managing the individual tribal member accounts that the Department of Interior oversees and is doing a heck of a poor job of overseeing.
Indeed.
So there's lots of corruption in Indian country, and it's to be found in the Indian governments, the tribal councils.
Indeed. Well, I have a feeling we're not done with this topic, Larry. I think it's going to keep on repeating in the future. And I have a feeling that as more information is discovered and as people follow the money, that we're going to have other interesting tidbits come out as to how our government is trying to use the Indian communities and how the Indian communities are trying to use the federal government and everybody else. Yeah, that's the problem. Everybody's using everybody, trying to get what they want. And now we've got Islamic countries like Turkey into the mix. They want to get what they want. Everybody's got the hand in somebody else's pocket, don't they?
Well, they seem to have their hands in every in American citizens' pocket.
Or in everybody's pocket simultaneously.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. That's just amazing.
That's really what you have. And
yeah.
Essentially, the Indian tribe should be respected as any other culture that is within our borders is. They should be allowed to practice their culture, their religion, their spiritual values as they see fit. But we all don't have to pay for it. That is a violation of the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution. The federal government, nor the state government, nor the local government can fund the practice of private practice of religion. But that's really what's occurring here.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at it,
Let me end this with this exhortation to anyone who lives close to an Indian reservation in America. Probably you Canadians ought to be thinking about this too. But if you are close by an Indian reservation, and if you follow the news that goes along with events on that reservation, watch them like a hawk from now on. Watch the news. Watch anything that comes out, any press release comes out, anything comes out, especially with relationship to what the federal government of the United States of America might be doing with any of the, with your local tribe. And also, if there's any foreign visitors coming to take a tour of that tribal land, or if those tribal leaders are being invited for expense-paid trips to places like Turkey. It could be, I suppose, Saudi Arabia could do the same thing. But I exhort you to watch the situation like a hawk. Keep your antennas up. Keep your ears open. Your eyes open. Don't be naive. I'd also advise you, if you drive across an Indian reservation, obey the speed limit. Because if you get picked up, you won't be calling your American lawyer to come get you out. Because you'll be subject to their law and their courts. And there are some pretty bad stories about how people have gotten tangled up with tribes for not obeying the laws of their land, which is not necessarily the laws of our land. And Larry, I thank you for coming on today. This has been really informative. I hope people can comprehend what we're talking about here. Even if they don't get it all, at least maybe it has piqued their curiosity to start paying attention.
Well, you're welcome, Pat, and I appreciate the opportunity to share what we have found with your audience, and perhaps we might have another occasion to revisit these issues.
I hope we do. I think there's going to be more to this story and others as well that's related, but we'll get to it and we'll stay on it because that's what we talk about on the Technocracy News Hour. So until next time, Larry, thank you so much for spending time, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you again, Pat. You take care now.
This concludes our broadcast for today. I am Patrick Wood, the host of Technocracy News Hour. On behalf of technocracy.news, please check out this website, technocracy.news, to stay abreast of all the current events going on in the world relating to technocracy and all of its surrounding elements. Please also do consider purchasing a copy of Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, available on Amazon.com and available on technocracy.news. Until next time, Godspeed.